North Oakland speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Veronica, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Veronica.
Hi. Please turn off your cell phones. Please help me open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. This is a speaker meeting. Missy will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Dave. We'll share his experience, strength, and hope. So speak for 10 minutes.
Ready? Here I go. Okay. Hi, I'm Missy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Missy.
I'm really nervous to be here. I'm from San Francisco and got a call this afternoon asking me to speak, and it's an honor to speak in front of you guys tonight. Hope you're not judging me too much. I don't know many of you. I've been sober since September 25th of 2005, and for that I'm very grateful. I got sober in San Antonio, Texas. I grew up in Texas. I'm a Southern girl, and I moved out here about 3 years ago to go to law school, and that was actually a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, because before I got sober, I wasn't very productive. There was no way I would be able to go to law school, that's for damn sure. So, you know, as a result of coming into the rooms and as a result of working the steps with a sponsor, my wildest dreams have been able to come true, and I've been able to really become the person that I've always dreamed of being. So, I guess I'll just start at what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So I grew up in Texas. I'm the oldest of three kids, and I grew up in an alcoholic family. And my mama really liked to drink, and I grew up in a lot of fear. Like, when mom picked up the bottle, I didn't know what was going to happen. My house was very chaotic. On the outside, it looked really great. Like, we grew up in the suburbs, we have two cars in the garage, like, you know, we had, like, the nice dog, the white picket fence, all that. But on the inside of my home, it was absolute chaos. And it was a really lonely place because I never invited friends over for fear that they would see my mom drinking and, like, God only knows what she would do when drinking. And so I kind of had to grow up really fast. And I took care of my younger brothers and sisters. And I wasn't a cute kid. We moved around a lot. I was really chunky. I had big glasses. And I had this awesome lazy eye, so like, you know, like I would move to schools and like, you know, I'd try to make friends and they'd be like, we're over here, like I'd be looking over here, you know, and that, of course, like, I'm an alcoholic from the gate, like I am just totally insecure, like I don't ever really remembering feeling comfortable in my own skin, so like that was just the icing on top of the freaking cake, right? And so we moved around a lot, and I never was really able to make friends, and I just like lived this alcoholic life and this alcoholic home. But the first time I ever felt relief, the first time I ever put anything into my system to change the way that I felt, I was 7 years old, and I was lucky enough to get eye surgery to like knock that sucker right back in place so I could actually like look and talk at you at the same time. And I remember being seven and going down into eye surgery and like kind of being scared, and them counting down to 10 and hooking me up to laughing gas and like loving that already. Like this can only get better, right? And the next thing I know, like I'm waking up in a hospital bed and I'm hooked up to IVs and morphine. And it's just like glorious. And I feel warm and I feel comfortable. And I feel like, I mean, I feel like I died and gone to heaven, you know? Like there wasn't a care, there wasn't a worry. I didn't want to go home. I remember them like slowly trying to wake me up to get me like ready to go home. I didn't want to go home. I wanted to stay there. And they gave me painkillers for the next 3 days, which I slept straight for the next 3 days. And I woke up and I went back to school, went to recess and told all my friends, like, if you can have eye surgery, like, you have got to do it. Like, it's the best shit in town. Like, if you've got a messed up eye, you get that shit fixed. And like, of course nobody knew what I was talking about. Of course I was like the weirdo again, right? And the reason I tell that story is because that same feeling that I felt at 7 years old, and it's like, it's still such a profound experience for me, I chase that feeling the rest of my drinking and using career. Like, just to numb out, just to get high, just to escape. Because, like, me sober, I am not a comfortable person. Me sober, I am, like, driven by 100 forms of fear. And I can't be present in my life. And I just absolutely, like, self-sabotage everything because I don't know how to live life on life's terms. And so I kid that I was, like, only sober for 6 months, but I really was because my mom, like, you know, she's, like, a hard-time drinker, and having three kids, that kind of gets in the way of it. So she would give us, like, sleeping pills and cough medicine and Benadryl every night. So I was never a kid that, like, you know, argued about going to bed early. Like, it was, like, after dinner, 6:37, time to go to bed, I was set. Like, I wanted something to make me pass out. And that's just how my household was. I didn't think that there was anything different. Like, my household, if you didn't feel good, there was always something in the pantry to change the way that you felt. We had more booze and we had more drugs than we had food, you know? And that was okay by us. That was completely okay. We could manage that way. And watching my mom drink, I swore I was never going to be an alcoholic. I swore, you know, like, I could deal with pills or whatever. But, like, you know, like, that's a whole different thing. But, like, I saw the kind of woman my mom became when she drank. It was the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde that they talk about in the book. And so I swore I was never going to be like that. And, like, most of her family members on her side have been locked up or they've died really young from this disease. So, like, I knew that this thing could have a power over me. And we moved a lot, and my parents moved me from public school to private school, and that was really awkward, and I, like, begged them not to move me from my friends, but the truth was I didn't have any friends at the time. And so I moved to private school. I went to an all-girls Catholic school, and I got thrown in with the volleyball players because I know it doesn't look like it, but I did play volleyball back in the day. I played main game, even though I'm, like, yay big. And I remember going out with these girls at the beginning of school one night, and they all started drinking, and, like, all those firm resolutions of, like, oh, I'm not going to be like my mom, I'm never going to drink, psh, out the window. And I drank with those girls that night. And I didn't get drunk that night. Like, a lot of people I hear in the rooms, like, just go balls to the wall the first night, like, fuck it. I tried to control my drinking that night, but what I can tell you was, like, I drank for the effect. And I got the ease and comfort out of that drink that I had been seeking forever. And I felt, like Bill says in his story, I had arrived, you know? And I thought, if I could just drink like these girls the rest of high school, I'll survive. It'll be fine. It'll be cool. They won't really get to know me, because if they really get to know me, they're not going to like me because I hate myself. I can't stand who I am. Like, I'm always in my head wondering what you're going to think of me, how you're sizing me up. You know, I just can't be okay in who I am. And so I proceeded to drink with these girls like the rest of high school. And I thought, you know what, I'll just drink a couple times on the weekends. Like, it'll be fine. And slowly but surely, like, I crossed that imaginary line, where, like, the weekends started Thursdays and started even Wednesdays. And, I got my car before everyone else. So, like, they were relying on me to drive them around town. And, you know, I couldn't be dependable anymore. I was the one, like, saying, okay, I'll drive, I'll be the DD. And at the end of the night, I'm floating the keg and I'm passed out. And I'm making up excuses, and I wasn't going home for, like, 3 or 4 days on end. And my parents, you know, they had their own shit. So they, like, didn't really worry what I was doing. And I made good grades. So they were like, as long as you get through school, make good grades, it's manageable, you're fine. And I told myself that for a really long time. And what happened was, is I moved from high school and I went to college and I followed my boyfriend, who is my higher power. And, you know, I told myself, like, I'll get this drinking thing under control. Like, I'll totally get this thing under control. I just need to change my outside circumstances, get some new friends. And I moved to San Antonio, Texas from Houston and joined a sorority, like, day two there. I didn't even give a shit about these girls. All I cared was that I could drink however much I wanted, whenever I wanted, and it was free. And that's the Greek life. You can just drink at your pleasure, at your leisure. And you know, that's when I really started experiencing my bottom, and that's when I really like realized that I had an obsession of the mind. When I wasn't drinking, when I was in class, I was thinking about drinking. I was thinking about who I was going to drink with, how I was going to drink, where I was going to get the booze, because I was like, you know, 19 years old and I look like I'm 12, right? So like a fake ID doesn't work too well for me. Like I was already manipulating, and like I could go a day or two without drinking as long as I was certain that the reward of like turning in a paper or a project was going to get me that next drink. And then I realized I had this phenomenon of craving. So like the second I put alcohol in my system, I'm worried about where the next drink is gonna come. I'm not worried about enjoying that drink. I'm not worried about the people who are with me. I'm worried about that next drink and then the drink after that. And I'm like that crazy, like I always thought I was like a weird bag lady. Like I'd always roll into a party with like a bag of my booze, right? And like I never ever put it down. Because like I didn't even care if I was drinking like, you know, like hot pours. Like it didn't matter. I didn't want to put it in the fridge, because if one of you guys took my beer, like that was not gonna be cool. If someone took my booze for that night, like that shit's not cool, because I needed alcohol to survive. I needed it to be okay. And the way I drank was I drank to get drunk, I drank to pass out. I'm a blackout drinker, so I would, you know, drink to oblivion and wake up the next day and feel that incomprehensible demoralization of like, oh shit, what did I do the night before? And I used to get really mean when I drank. I used to fight. I had a boyfriend. That boyfriend I followed to college broke up with me because he said I was crazy, which I was. And I got a boyfriend who was my drug dealer, and he used me for me, essentially like arm candy and sex, and I used him for drugs and booze. And he was a bouncer at a bar. And you know, where my drinking took me was I started drinking at bars on like the south side of San Antonio, and I compromised who I was as a woman, like completely, like emotionally, physically, sexually, like just completely compromised myself. I had no self-respect, and I was reading the doctor's opinion with my sponsor the other day, and it says that like, and I heard this in a meeting last night, is like the alcoholic like is willing to give up that like utmost sacrifice, like I'm totally paraphrasing this, for the next drink. But like the thing that we hold most dear to our hearts, the thing that we value the most, like when it comes between that and picking up a drink and like drinking, like I'm always gonna choose booze. That's my master. I need that to be okay. And I'm grateful that I hit a bottom with alcohol. And what happened was, I ended up having like a binge of a weekend. I tried to beat up my boyfriend, who was like 280 and 6'4", and I thought it was a fair fight. And he broke up with me, and I always said, if I'm as bad as this guy, then I got some issues. And he was breaking up with me, like, don't you know what you're doing? And he wanted nothing to do with me anymore. And I had a friend who had a brother who learned how to drink in AA, and I was like, that's what I need to do. Like, who else to teach me better but you guys, right? Like, you know how to fucking drink, so you can give me the ropes on how to control this drinking so that I'm not suffering consequences anymore, and I'm not burning bridges with the people that I love, and I can get out of bed in the morning and do what I'm supposed to do. What? Oh, I have 2 minutes? Shit. I gotta get sober. What happened was, you know, I came in and I had the gift of desperation, and I worked the steps like my life depended on it. And I got a sponsor who didn't give me suggestions. She gave me subtle commands, because I was dying inside when I came in. You know, for me, it was like I knew I was alcoholic, and I knew that if I continued to try to use something outside of myself to fix who I was, like, I was going to fucking die. And so I worked this program like my life depended on it, and I got service commitments. I got involved in the middle of the herd, because that's what we call in Texas. It's not the boat, it's the herd. I got in the middle of the herd, and I let you guys carry me. You know, I followed by your example. If I had to go to 3 meetings in a day because my ass was falling off, you know what? I did it. Because if I don't put sobriety first before everything else, I lose whatever I put before sobriety. And I've worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous so many times. I tend to work the steps over every year. And my wildest dreams have come true. Like, I've been able to travel internationally sober. I've been able to go to meetings like all over the country sober. I was able to go to the International Convention in San Antonio, where I got sober, and introduce California friends to the people I got sober with, and create this like web of community. And I was able to go to law school, and that's been a big dream of mine. Like, because I've been of service in AA, and because I continuously work with sponsees, and I continuously try to give back so freely, which is what's been given to me, I want to be of service in my life. And, like, my ultimate passion and dream is to be an attorney for children. That's what I want to do. I want to help kids and support them and get what they need that I didn't necessarily get as a child. And Alcoholics Anonymous told me how to do that. You guys showed me. You showed me how to show up for my life and to trust that, like, you know, every year, like, God's got a plan for me. He's got, like, this divine plan for me. I just have to do the next right thing. And when I don't know what the answer is, I have to follow the lead of you guys. So I really wish I could have talked more about the steps. I'm sure Dave will do that in the book. But that's where the solution is. The solution is in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you are newly sober, I encourage you to grab somebody in this room. I encourage you to get a hold of that book. I encourage you to start on the steps and to, like, just be willing. Just maintain that willingness, because your life is going to take off and you don't even know where it's going to go, and it's going to be amazing. So thank you.
Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to tonight's speaker, Dave.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. That was amazing. We can all go home.
No.
See, it only takes 10 minutes to carry the message. Thanks to Mick for asking me to speak. I think the last time I spoke at this meeting was January 2010, 2.5 years ago. So I'm super glad to be here. And welcome to the folks who are new. Even and especially if you didn't announce yourself, I've been new twice in AA. And both times I was really uncomfortable physically and mentally and spiritually, and both times it got better over time. So I do hope you'll stay. Before I start talking, I just want to read a couple things from the book, just to, you know, put my head in the game in a way. So in How It Works, it says our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And, you know, I used to misquote this and mishear this. A lot of people, including me, say, you know, I'm going to follow the standard format, what it was like and what happened, what it's like now. That's an understandable misunderstanding. But to me, the what we used to be like, the singular of that is what I used to be like. So I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about what I was like when I was drinking, what I was like, not what it was like. When I first came to AA, I would hear stories about 2 bottles of vodka a day and people, you know, urinating on themselves in their sleep and all this stuff, none of which had happened to me. That was what it was like for them. But when I heard people talk about how they felt when they were at the end of their drinking, you know, spiritually bankrupt, hurt, in pain, their life a wreck, I related. Like, that made sense to me. So that's the beginning thing. And then my sponsor pointed this out when we met on Tuesday, and I really like this. It's talking about, at the end of the chapter called There's a Solution, it's talking about what's coming up in the book. You know, this is the very end of the chapter, and they say, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 43 personal experiences. And the directions mean the 12 steps, I assume. And then they go on to talk about these stories that are, you know, that they're in the second half of this book. And they say each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. So I'm going to try to stick with that too tonight. And I don't know if I'll manage to, but really, it seems like I'm charged to tell you a little bit about how I came to find and believe in a higher power that could solve the problems I couldn't seem to solve when I was drinking. And then I'm reminded, finally, and on page 45, it talks about how lack of power was our dilemma, and we had to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, and power greater than ourselves is in italics, you know, like, it had to be a power greater than ourselves. And then there's a one-word sentence after that. Obviously. You fucking morons. You tried, you failed, you gotta find a power greater than yourself. And then it says, but where and how were we to find this power? And the next sentence says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Mm. So they tell us exactly what the book is about. The people who wrote the book told us exactly what the book is about. It is, next sentence, its main object, the book, is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. So I was born December 14th, 1956. I'm 55 years old. I started smoking cigarettes when I was 12. I smoked pot for the first time when I was 14, and I'm only mentioning an outside substance in AA because it was the first time that I changed my consciousness by ingesting something. Yeah. And it was a glorious moment in my life. I was at the beach at Paparo Dunes. A couple of families were down there, and we kids were like on the beach, and there were homes over here. And I think one of them had, you know, they had like lights on the porches of the homes, so the sand was lit up and the ocean was over here, and we were all sitting around, and they passed around a joint, and we all smoked a joint, and all of a sudden, the ocean is like, and I stood up, and I was like, I started to walk away from the campfire, and the sand is lit up, so, you know, there's light and shadow and light and shadow because it's sand with little divots in it and whatnot. It's a beach. And so I felt like I was on the moon. You know? I was walking along on the moon. And I don't know if I had this thought in language consciously, but I know I had this thought. And the thought was basically, I'm 14 years old. If I live to 84, that's 70 years. I want to do this every fucking day. I've got 70 years. And so, happily, it was the 1970s, so it was around and easier, much easier to get than alcohol. My first drink was when I was 15, and you know, I grew up in an upper middle class family down on the peninsula. I had a lot of opportunities and privileges that I know that a lot of people don't have. I was very lucky. And I blew a lot of them through drinking and using. But in this particular case, I was sent to Europe one summer for 6 weeks with a group of kids to ski in the morning and play tennis in the afternoons. And and one day we went, I think we were in Austria, and we went to a like Oktoberfest kind of festival, but in August. And and it was the whole thing, man. It was like an amusement park with rides thing, and there was this big, huge tent with long wooden picnic tables and Fraulein's and Lederhosen with 18 steins per hand, you know, bringing it to the table. And the drinking age at that point in Europe was like 2, I think. So, again, the benefits of growing up in the 70s as a drunk. And so my older brother had told me how to drink. He said, you know, drink your first beer slowly and wait 10 minutes for the effect, and then drink slowly and wait 10 minutes and drink slowly. And what he would do was he had no tolerance for alcohol, so he would go out with his swim team buddies and drink a lot, I guess really fast, and come home and get sick. And I didn't want to get sick, so I tried the way he was telling me rather than what he was doing. So I drank one of those big beers slowly, and I went around on the rides and fucked around with my friends and whatnot. Then I drank another one and another, and I had a fabulous first drunk. You know what I mean? We got on the bumper cars, smashing into each other, laughing like crazy. And although there was one sad, sad moment, I kissed a girl. The tragedies of alcoholism. So, but I straightened that out quickly and met a lot of guys and drank with them. And then Missy's story reminded me that I guess the other significant getting loaded story in my life was I was in the hospital when I was 15. And they were, I was there for an operation, and in those days you stayed the night before, and my family came, and I think it was 1972, so my brother brought me Sticky Fingers, the Stones album, as a hospital gift. It's an awesome album, by the way, you should know. And my mom was there, and they came. The nurses came in to prepare me for the operation. And what they did was they shot me up with sodium pentothal, and otherwise known as truth serum, which I knew from reading spy novels. So I guess it's a morphine derivative, but I started talking. And at one point, and now, mind you, I've been getting stoned and now drunk for a couple of years. I turned to my mom and I looked at her and I apparently said, I don't remember this, God, am I stoned. And then I looked away and started talking to my brother again. And then they wheeled me downstairs and I was waiting on the gurney in the hallway, and I was really, really high. And I was laughing at what Missy was saying, because I remember in that bubble of being high on the fucking gurney, I remember thinking, if heroin is anything like this, I have to stay away. Like, I have to stay away. I will live here. This is so good. And, you know, I was a huge Rolling Stones fan, so Keith Richards was a junkie at the time, and Hunter S. Thompson. I mean, I was like, really into, like, artists and musicians who were addicts and alcoholics. And so I was just a little suburban boy, but I knew of that. And I remember thinking that if heroin is anything like this. So what happened for me was what basically happens for all of us, which was I drank and used in increasing proportions over the next 15 years. So, you know, from starting from 14 to about 30, 31. And it got progressively worse. And I went to a big fancy brand name university, one of the privileges of my upbringing, and didn't finish because I found it more pleasant to get loaded and ignore the fact that I was actually in school than complete my assignments or figure out how many units I had and stuff like that. So it was a great shame to me that I didn't finish that university. I was hugely ashamed of that for a really long time. And I stumbled into the adult world, and literally, I mean, well, not literally, but I might as well have literally stumbled into the adult world. The launching I was meant to have wasn't, and so I just sort of messed around and couldn't find any direction. And I was getting loaded and getting loaded, playing music, doing this, doing that. And then finally I struck a career, and presently moved to San Francisco in 1983. And I got to San Francisco, that was in my mid-20s, and I was just kind of finishing coming out as a gay man, because that whole process had been very, very uncomfortable. And people started dying of AIDS in the early 80s. And so I moved into a community that was beginning to suffer a lot of death. And my work was involved with that, and my entire life was wrapped up with AIDS and disease and death and loss at what to me feels like a now very, if not relatively, young age. So it was, I think the end of my drinking, it was basically the threat of my work getting worse. I'm totally a workhorse. Like, when I'm working, I believe in working. What I do comes from my heart, not from having a job, although it is a job. And so my personal relationships were a mess. Everything had dissolved. But it was the fact that my work might fall apart that I think, you know, caught my attention. And through a couple of really, really nice coincidences, I realized that I had a problem with alcohol and made a decision in August of 1988 to stop drinking. So I stopped drinking on my own, not knowing that I might be detoxing after 18 years. And severely out of my mind, both of which I did and was. But when I turned 30 the year before, I had stopped getting loaded for 8 months and had therefore proved to myself I didn't have a problem, I think, in my mind. And then I met a guy and fell in love, and he liked to do ecstasy, and I was like, never done it, let's try. And so that began the last year of my drinking, which was 1 year, and things just went completely downhill. So September of 1988, I came back to the city after traveling with my boyfriend, and I had stopped drinking 2 weeks before, and I went to the Stud, the bar that I like to hang out in, and there was this guy, and my boyfriend and I had an open relationship. That worked well. There was this really cute guy. I was dancing. It was 1 a.m, and he had a big mohawk and a leather jacket, and he was cute. And he eyed me, and I eyed him, and so I went up and talked to him, and he said, can I get you a drink? And I said, sure. And we went to the bar, and he said, well, you have? And I said, I guess just a Calistoga. And he goes, oh, you don't drink? And I said, no, I just stopped. And he said, oh, I don't either. So we got 2 Calistogas, and I said, and then he said that he was in AA. And I was like, really? And so... And so he and I went to Church Street Station, which is a restaurant at the corner of Church and Market Streets, where Home is now not anymore. And all-night restaurant, you know, crappy coffee, the whole thing. We talked till 6 a.m. about AA and sobriety. And then we slept together. But you see, God knows me well. And he had to put AA in a package that I might recognize. Or at least be attracted to. And Wade did no promoting. He did a lot of attracting. So I started going to AA in September of 1988. And I was sober with a lot of fellowship and a lot of meetings, and I learned how to live life differently, and things got better and better and better. And then I was with another relationship in 1997, and I was diagnosed in the summer of 97 with a mental health kind of thing and put on medications. And I had been chronically insomniac for my whole adult life. And so the psychiatrist said, oh, I can give you something to help you sleep. And I said, well, now I'm a recovering addict and alcoholic, no narcotics. You know, I can't be like Valium and shit like that. And he said, oh, no, it's this new stuff. It's fine. It's not addictive. It's called Ambien. So I started taking Ambien. And it was new on the market, and I didn't know anything about it except that when I took it at night, I could go to sleep. That's all I knew. And after not knowing when I was going to go to sleep for 20 years, it was a huge relief. So immediately I was psychologically dependent on it because it let me sleep in a way that I hadn't been able to. But I now understand that it's an addictive substance, and so it provided a little bit of termites in the wood, in the structure of my sobriety, and certainly started the craving, the physical craving that I didn't know I had. And so in December, my boyfriend and I broke up at the time. We were living together, so I couch surfed with friends for a while because I didn't want to be around him. And then, just through a series of things, 3 weeks later, I wound up using. And the thing that I used was, and it was for one night, although I was kind of beginning to misuse those pills too, but not telling myself it was happening. This relapse was slow and strange. And it took me a few years to put it all together, actually, looking back. But the thing I relapsed on was something I'd never done before, which is heroin. The thing I said I would never do again. You know, at 15, I was like, I gotta stay away from this shit. And at 41, I was like, yeah, bring it. Happily, I was getting the flu the night that I relapsed. I was becoming physically very sick. The drugs made me sicker. And I got so sick for a week that I could actually think about what I had done. And it arrested the physical ability to use. I was just too goddamn sick. You know, I was throwing up and sick. And so I don't know because it's the road not taken, but I strongly suspect and really felt like if I hadn't gotten sick, I would definitely have kept using. There's almost no question in my mind. In part because what the hell, I've used, so why not? But I think in the more subtle way of having the cravings for physical cravings enacted or enlivened by the pills and then the drugs, and then the psychological dependency, and also the kind of fuck it thing that I was going through, I'm pretty sure I would have used and used a lot. And so it's just happenstance that I got really sick and couldn't. But for that week, I moved back in with my boyfriend or went back to the apartment, and he would work during the day and sleep at night, so I would stay up all night in a different room and then go sleep in our bed during the day when he was gone. And I remember, like, it was a very difficult week, and somewhere in the middle of the week, I said to myself, I looked at the night that I had used and what had led up to it, and I thought, without going into sort of details, I realized it was this very slow suicide. I was in five or six places where I could have been killed. And again, not to be dramatic or grandiose, it could have just simply happened. Plus, I was an AIDS educator, for Christ's sake. The guy had a dirty rig. I made us walk all the way to Safeway and get bleach and, like, clean the rig. But I mean, a clean relapse, everybody. So, no, I put myself at risk for HIV. I put myself at risk to, once I'd passed out, to be conked over the head and have everything stolen. I mean, we were walking around the Tenderloin to score at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I don't know anything about the Tenderloin, and I have no skills on the streets. So there are... hard to tell, I know. So then I thought to myself, well, and this may be crazed detox thinking, but it was actually felt like a deeper place. I thought, if it really was a slow suicide, why don't you look at that? And if you really want to end, why don't you actually do it and take responsibility? So I gave myself a choice. Do you want to live or die? And that was about Wednesday of that week. The relapse was a Sunday night. Monday I went home. Very, very sick all week. And once I put it in those stark terms, I knew I wanted to live. You know, it wasn't, I just couldn't imagine killing myself. And so to live, I knew I had to be sober. And to be sober, I knew I had to go to AA. And so on Saturday of that week, I was well enough. I was living at 17th and Dolores Streets in the city, and High Noon was at 19th and Dolores. So on Saturday, I staggered down to High Noon and raised my hand. I'm a newcomer. My name is Dave. And, and you know, I'd been around for 9+ years, so people kind of knew me and stuff. So it was embarrassing. And but what was more shocking was, A, that I'd relapsed, and B, that I was craving getting high. And again, it took me a few years to understand. I'd stopped taking the pills. I was fucking detoxing. You know what I mean? I'd stopped taking the Ambien because of the relapse. And I was detoxing, so I was craving getting high in a way I'd never had the first time. And mentally thinking about drug spots I would hear about in meetings. And you and I could right now walk down to any one of those drug spots, and I could not show you who the dealers are. But still my mind would tell me, you know, that spot. So that scared me, and I was very, very confused and bewildered and shocked that I had relapsed. And you know, I was nine years and four months sober, and I know in a corner of my mind that I thought time was keeping me sober. And one minute I was 9 years and 4 months sober, and the next minute I was 0 months, zero anything sober. And ever since then, I've worn time very loosely. I don't even, this is my decision, but I don't even say I have 14 years or whatever. I have simply been sober for 14 years, or I'm sober now. I have nothing. It's all God's. So anyway, at High Noon, I started to go to High Noon every day, and there was this guy with really long hair. He's about this tall. You know, I mean, I'm small, but he was small. And he was very tough, you know, and I was super depressed, so I was watching like 4 reruns a day on cable of NYPD Blue. And there's this character on that show called Sipowicz. And he's an asshole. And Mike reminded me of Sipowicz. And so I kept introducing myself, saying I'm an addict and alcoholic, my name is Dave, and I'm 10 days back from the relapse, and 12 days and 15 days. And at Saturday High Noon one week, about 2 weeks sober, Mike was the secretary, and it's a big book study, and he said something about the book. And I had one of those moments where I was like, that guy. That's my sponsor. And so I went up to him after the meeting and said, hey, would you consider being my sponsor? And he said, sure. And we worked together for the first 7 years of my sobriety, and he was kind enough to wait about 3 years to tell me that when he saw me crossing High Noon after the meeting coming towards him, he was like, oh no, not this guy. Oh no. So he said to me, okay, sure. Why don't we start this way? Why don't you just introduce yourself as an alcoholic like everybody else? And stop saying how many days you're back from a relapse. You're a newcomer. Raise your hand. When they ask for newcomers, say your name and say you're an alcoholic. I was appalled, insulted, but I took his direction and I was kind of relieved. And then he said, get a hardcover big book, a highlighter, and a pen. Mm-hmm. Call me every day and bring those things and meet me next week, Saturday High Noon, and we'll read the book together. So next Saturday, I showed up with this particular softcover big book that I had scrambled to find 10 minutes before the meeting in my house, and a flare pen, because I always write with flare pens because I like them. Here it is, this one. Yeah? So I showed up with this. And we sat in Mike's little car, and he rolled up the windows because it was an El Nino year, so it was raining like cats and dogs, and it was January or early February, and he chain-smoked Marlboros, and he said, how many meetings did you go to this week? And I said, I don't know, I did pretty well, about five. And he said, what happened to going to a meeting a day? What's wrong with you? Why don't you follow directions? Mind you, I wasn't working or doing anything. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, sorry. And then he said, all right. He said, okay, do you have the highlighter and the book, you know, the big book and stuff? And I said, oh, well, I found this book, and here, I got this pen. And he said, wow, you just don't follow directions, do you? And then he said, I'll see you next week. Get out of the car. And I was like, so me being me, on every level that I am me, uh-huh. I showed up the next week with the same book and the same and Mike looked at me and shook his head very sadly and then said, all right, open to the first page. And so what we did was, he would tell me where to highlight and underline, and where he said to underline, I would make a straight line, and where he said to highlight, I'd make a squiggle. And what we did was we read the book together. Mm-hmm. And then he would be reading on this page over here. He read the book to me and told me where to highlight and underline. I know, I went to the fancy university, Mike. I've done this before. But he was reading one time on this page, and I looked on this page, the right page, and I saw that he had a couple marks, so I started marking my book, you know, just looking like that. And he looked at me and he said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I just noticed you had a couple marks on that page, so I was going to put them in. And he said, did I tell you to do that? No. And he said, then don't do it. Why don't you follow direction? And so I learned, slowly, that I have trouble following directions. I learned that I will do anything I please if it suits me. That is my alcoholic condition. I will do whatever the hell I want. I will dress it up in motives that sound really good, but I am entirely self-centered and self-obsessed and entitled. And I think the rules don't apply to me. And Mike taught me that by telling me probably 1,000 times in the first year that I don't know how to follow directions. Anyway, we read the book chapter by chapter. He told me where to highlight and underline. I made lines and squiggles. And in that way, we worked the steps. It had taken me the first time I got sober 3 years to do a fourth step. This time it took me 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Because I was really afraid I was going to use, and I was out of my fucking mind. And so by the summer of 1998, or maybe the early fall, I was ready to sponsor people. And I was like, oh shit, It's kind of like where you feel like you're going to graduate and you realize, I wish I'd studied, you know, at all. I was like, and so I actually, and you know, so I've been restored to a bit of sanity and was appreciative of AA and was having a great, you know, a great time and a great life. And I sort of went back to Mike one time and was like, if I get a hardcover big book and a highlighter and a pen, will you read the book with me again? And he said, sure, I got nothing better to do. Oh, and because here's what's happened. I dropped it in a puddle and all the shit, all the flair handwriting smeared. So Mike had said, when I said, Mike, how do I sponsor people? I don't know what to do. He said, just do what I did with you. Read the book, tell them where to highlight and underline, and don't put yourself in there at all. You know what I mean? Don't put yourself in there. You, Dave. And, but I was like, it's smeared. So Mike and I sat in his new car and read the book, and I was sane now, so I had a hardcover book and a highlighter and a pen. And because of all the changes that had happened, I'd been estranged from my dad for 8 years and then gotten in touch with him to make an amend, made an amend, and suddenly he died 3 months later. In September, well, that was November of 98. And so I'd had all these miraculous things happening, and I was so grateful. And sitting with Mike, now relatively sane, and reading the book again, I felt like I was being read a bedtime story. It was like the highlight of my week. And so I began doing that with guys. When they'd show up without the highlighter and the pen and stuff, I'd tell them to go home, just like Mike did. And yeah, I wasn't really popular then. But the first guy I sponsored that we read the book all the way through, and he did a four, well, all the way through to the fourth step. He did a fourth step, and then we took his fifth step, and it was a Saturday evening, and I think I was speaking at a meeting or had to do something at a meeting. And so we took a long bit of fifth step sort of Saturday afternoon for 3 or 4 hours, and then the time ended that I had to get ready for this other thing. So I said, come back tomorrow morning, and we'll finish your fifth step. Come back at 9 a.m. And I didn't hear from him the next morning. That was Sunday, this guy who I was sponsoring. And Monday, and then Tuesday he called and he said, I said, what happened? And he said, oh, I went home Saturday night and I drank. I was like, well, are you okay? Blah, 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 let's talk. And then I called Mike immediately, and Mike, what have I done? I'm a terrible sponsor. Like I had this, I shouldn't have stopped the fifth step. I made the guy drink, blah, blah, blah. And Mike being Mike, he just sort of said, Dave, who made you God? And Mike kept having ways, and all the sponsors I've worked with, and hopefully maybe I've done a little of this with my guys, and without even trying. I mean, we all do it to each other and for each other in meetings when we share. We just say things that shift the perspective just slightly, you know what I mean? And suddenly it's okay. And when Mike said that thing, what he followed up by saying is, he said he wanted more what's in the bottle than what we have at that moment. That's all that happened. You can't keep him sober and you can't get him drunk. And that was a great lesson for me. And so since then, I've sponsored lots and lots of people. And I just have a couple minutes left. So all I want to say is this. I love sponsoring alcoholics. I've learned by sitting across a table from alcoholics what sober alcoholism looks like. I've learned also what sober recovery looks like, what the hand of God to me looks like, what I define as God. You know, what that change looks like. And it's miraculous. At about a year sober, I said something in a meeting from the floor, and Mike came up to me after, and he said, wow, where did that come from? And I was like, I don't know. And he was recognizing a change in me and pointing it out. And so I've never seen this thing not work when people followed the simple directions, you know, and tried to do this thing. And the challenge for me over time has been being sober a long time. I've been sober a lot longer than I was the first time. And there's sometimes when it seems a long and boring march, you know what I mean? And what I try to do is to keep in mind that AA has given me everything that I have. And so if I can pay back even an eighth of that, you know, I wish I could pay back 100%. How do you give a life? And so I really feel like I owe, but in the best way. not the sense of alcoholic obligation, like, oh God, I have to do this goddamn thing. But truly, from a deep place, I kind of feel like I continue to owe, and it's my responsibility. And my sponsor and I, who's been sober now 28 years, and I talk quite a bit, or he talks quite a bit, and I listen closely about, as I'm around AA more, like, I'm one of the, hopefully, many people who have been sober for a while who keep participating and shepherding this thing along, you know, based on the traditions and stuff. AA is only 77 years old. We haven't even hit the 100-year mark. I mean, you know, we could splinter off into a whole bunch of factions and shit, you know, and this whole thing could go nuts. We're all crazy. Yes. So, learning more about the traditions, you know, participating in service work, and really, you know, through sponsorship is I've just had a really, really good life so far. So for the new folks, I'm not sure if much of what I said, especially in the latter part, because it had more to do with being sober for a while, rang any bells, but the whole reason we're here is not to drink. You know, just a day at a time. And coming to a lot of meetings helps. Talking to AAs when you want to drink helps. It helped me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just know that it's possible not to drink. And you don't have to think about December or New Year's or anything else. It's just possible not to drink. And in fact, as far as I can tell, and I can see pretty much all of you, nobody's drinking right now in this room. That's a fucking miracle.
Thank you guys. Okay. I'd like to re-welcome the newcomers and the visitors. Awesome speakers, again, Missy and Dave. And please help me close the meeting.
To accept the things that cannot change, and the courage to change.